Welcome to another edition of the 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Nancy Lublin is a mover and a shaker, a change maker, an innovator, an entrepreneur, visionary, businesswoman, CEO, and most importantly of all, my guest today. In 1995, during Nancy's first year of law school, her great-grandfather died. He left her $5,000. Wanting to honor his memory, 23-year-old Nancy came up with the idea for Dress for Success. And who has not heard of Dress for Success? It helps women transition from welfare to work by providing interview outfits and career development training. It eventually morphed into one of the most popular and recognizable charity brands in America and can be found in more than 120 cities in 10 countries. Nancy's also been on interviews. In 2003, she joined DoSomething.org, the largest organization for teens looking to make social change. She's the CEO. She joined Do Something at a very critical time. It was $250,000 in debt. 21 out of a staff of 22 had just been laid off. Nancy did something right, all right, turning the organization around big time. Last year, more than 2.2 million teens participated in DoSomething.org cause campaigns, making it the largest organization of its kind. So I'm going to do something, and I'm going to welcome Nancy to the 51%. Conversations with Creative Women. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Your reputation precedes you.
Uh-oh.
Let's go back to that first year at law school at NYU. Oh. I read that it took you all of 1 week to realize you hated it.
I was so unhappy. I went to law school. I think I wanted to be Victor Cifuentes from L.A. Law. Do you remember L.A. Law?
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to like, save
like
the world. I don't look like him. I wanted to like save the world and make the world a better place and like wield my law degree as a weapon for social change. And I got to law school and they were all miserable trolls who wanted to do tax law.
And so boring.
Oh, my gosh. So dull. And like the big thing that law students were pissed off about was we want more faculty of color. And I was like, okay, well, that's good. But how about we're across from Washington Square Park where, like, human beings are being bought and sold and there's,
and
like, drugs and all kinds
park.
Of
things. Right.
In those days, Washington Square Park was not the glamorous place that it is now. It was a shithole.
Well, that's where I went to undergraduate school.
In Washington Square Park?
Well, across the street. My roommate was always bringing somebody home from the park. That's where we met Satan and his friend Rex.
Awesome.
But that's another
that
topic.
That sounds like a pretty good story. Yeah, so, and I was like, it was just such a stark contrast. And so when I got that check from my great-grandfather out of the blue, I think it's probably no surprise that I created something that was so tangible and so immediate because law school was so nebulous and amorphous and just stupid that I had to do something where Dress for Success is like women come in looking and feeling one way. And, you know, 45 minutes later, they leave looking and feeling ready to tackle the world and reclaim their destinies and all kinds of other good stuff. And I think that's because of the situation I was in. My grandfather used to like to say that good things grow in dirt. And law school was the dirt. I mean, I was so unhappy. Great things come from misery. Entrepreneurs, I don't know if you've had lots of entrepreneurs sit in the chair, but like a lot of entrepreneurs will tell you, I was really unhappy or I was going through this awful thing and I had this great idea.
But where did it come from? I mean, you could have had another great idea. You could have found the cure for cancer.
I don't know. No.
All right.
But
seriously,
why
did
that?
You make that match?
Yeah.
Albeit a brilliant one. How was that personal to you?
I mean, a couple things. One is my grandparents and my great-grandfather had all been in the garment industry, so I guess clothing was kind of in my blood, but my parents weren't in the industry. It's kind of skipped a generation, so maybe that was back there. But I think more it's like, I don't know, I'm a woman, you're a woman, we get dressed every day, and the skirt that you wear on Monday morning is sort of 2 sizes larger and 2 inches longer than the skirt you wear on a Saturday night.
Right.
And like a skirt is not a skirt is not a skirt, whereas a guy can wear the same blue blazer to get married, you know, go to court, go to a job interview, go on a date. Like he needs one blue blazer and a bunch of shirts. And our clothing is really complicated and really expensive. And I guess I understood that and thought, well, if you didn't have a closet full of suits, what would you do on a job interview? And I kind of wanted to help, like I said, help people get started here the way this country allowed my great-grandfather to get started.
So what'd you do with the $5,000? How'd you spend it?
This was awesome. So the next day I went to law school and asked a professor what I should do. And I was connected with a nun in Spanish Harlem, which is a little weird for a Jewish girl from Hartford,
well,
right?
Well, in addition to which, she's not making a fashion statement.
Oh, no. Oh, but she is. Yeah. You just haven't seen it. So I met with three nuns in Spanish Harlem and immediately fell in love with them. And then I made a fatal error, which was I took financial advice from people who have taken an oath of poverty. Not a good idea. So the nuns told me to put the $5,000 into a CD in the bank because it would collect interest, which was a lovely idea, except it meant that we started the organization with no money.
Right?
So for 6 months, we had
no money.
But
a prayer.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, a lot of prayer. Thank you. Yeah. So I am grateful to American Express for only turning off my card once that year. And there's a reason why American Express is the card of entrepreneurs and why they do, because there's no APR. You just pay that one. So I paid that one flat $55 fee and I could use my little green Amex card
whenever I want it.
So it was terrific. So I'm grateful, eternally grateful to Amex.
Well, that's a nice plug for them. Maybe
then
they'd like to advertise.
Like they've supported me. I'm just a supporter.
Okay, so Sister Mary, whatever.
Actually, you're right. How'd you know?
Because
they're all Mary, aren't they? Fairly common.
Sister
Mary, Sister Kathleen, and Sister Catherine, who I affectionately refer to as my three nuns.
Okay. There's a sitcom.
Yeah.
So you all joined forces together to create Dress for Success.
They came up with a name. I couldn't say it with a straight face for several months because I thought it was so hokey. But it turns out it was a darn good name. It's descriptive. It explains exactly what it is. I don't know why so many not-for-profits have names that are like acronyms that are silly abbreviations that make no sense.
Like DFS.
Right. That mm-hmm. would make no sense. So Dress for Success was actually pretty darn good.
And you went to department stores to buy your clothing?
We didn't buy any. So the first thing we did was we did a suit drive.
Collected clothing.
Yeah, we collected used clothing, gently used clothing. The JCC on the Upper West Side did a suit drive, and we had a space that had been donated to us. And 2 days before everything was to be delivered to this space, it had a pipe burst, and there was water damage. And you can't put clothing where there's been water damage. So everything came to my apartment.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my gosh.
Which was not awesome. So all the blouses hung, you know, from the shower curtain.
And God knows they couldn't go to, it's not a nunnery, to the convent.
Yeah,
I couldn't think of the word. Right.
And there was like in the crisper, in the fridge was all the jewelry. And I shoved shoes in the oven. Clearly, I'm not much of a cook. There was stuff everywhere. And then we found a space. It was great, actually right across the street from the law school. And so we got a space in the basement of a church. And
you started this first year of law school or second year?
In my first year of law school, I had the idea.
I understand. Yeah. But the second
year of law school, everything, all the clothing arrived and we really started doing stuff.
So these three nuns and you all gave birth to this organization.
We did. I had some other volunteers at the law school who were really helpful. And, you know, I tried to convince some friends and family to help out. And then what we did was the way that you got a suit was you came by referral from another not-for-profit. We didn't want to screen women and say whether or not women were eligible. Mm-hmm. So instead we screened their organization. So we would approve a domestic violence shelter or a homeless shelter. And the deal was we would dress everyone you sent to us so long as you sent a volunteer one day a month.
Great idea.
Which was really awesome because then usually the volunteer would be the person who was making the referrals. So like the Coalition for the Homeless would send their point person to us and that person would really get to know Dress for Success and would cherish it and so would only refer people who really were ready for job interviews.
And did anybody come individually?
Never.
So
they have to come by referral. And that's still a policy at Dress for Success. You can't just walk past on the street and show up like a store. It's by referral only.
So what was your job?
Amassing the clothes wasn't my job. I mean, I sorted clothing. I pulled more all-nighters doing Dress for Success than in any school I ever went to. I mean, I sorted clothes. This is what's great about startups. You do everything. I oversaw the audit. I raised the money. Wrote copy for pamphlets and flyers. I sent out the thank you notes. I sorted the suits. I dressed the clients.
And you found time to go to class?
Not really.
Right.
So I kind of ran across the street for classes sometimes. And then I remember hiring our first employee. She was a former client and she was awesome. And that was a real watershed moment. Hiring your first employee. When you're 23 years old also and you hire your first employee, it's pretty darn exciting.
And that hire came from the $5,000?
Yeah. No, that actually, it's a great story. So we, the 5,000 had come and gone, and we had a little other money here and a little money there. And it was, we knew we needed somebody else. I couldn't do the whole thing alone. And so the New York Community Trust, I submitted an application to them for 25,000. This is a great story. And Pat White, I will never forget her name, came to do a site visit from the New York Community Trust to interview me. And we sat down. And for some reason, I was so nervous and so, and she was so tough. I just started bawling. I mean, in the middle of the interview, like tears streaming down my face. And she didn't do kind of like the normal thing, which is, are you okay? Or would you like a Kleenex? She just kept going as if nothing had happened. Kind of like when you're in an elevator and someone farts and no one says anything. She was like that. It was like I hadn't cried at all. And I was bawling. It ended, and I was so embarrassed. It ended.
And you thought, there's no way.
There's no way. And a couple of weeks later, a check came in the mail.
For 25,000.
Oh, and I was, great. And so we used that money actually to hire our first person. But Pat White, I hope you're listening.
I don't mean to keep dwelling on this, because you're not the first person who started a company or an organization. But how the hell did you know what you were doing?
I didn't. I totally didn't. Our first lawyer, we had a, and remember, I was in law school. We had a pro bono attorney at Loeb & Loeb, at a law firm uptown. And so we had this pro bono attorney, and I go up there to meet with her to get things rolling. And she says, okay, so we're going to incorporate. We have to form a corporation. And I was like, no, that's, you don't understand. I'm forming a not-for-profit. She was like, yeah, that's a legal term. Everybody needs to incorporate. I said, okay, all right, fine. And she says, so you're going to need a secretary. Who's going to be your secretary? And I said, that is so bourgeois, and I don't even drink coffee. I'm not going to have a secretary. I don't think you understand what I'm talking about. And she was like, Nancy, every legal corporation needs to have a secretary. It's a legal term. So, I mean, I really did not know what I was doing in the early days. And, you know, fast forward 7 years later, I knew what I was doing. But I really learned more doing Dress for Success in those early days. And I always say to people, I never wrote a business plan. You don't sit down in Starbucks hunched over a laptop writing a business plan. You do it. You make that product or service. You live with your target market and love your target market. I mean, I learned so much. It was all hands-on.
I wonder if in a case like this, because other people have wonderful ideas and have the drive and the excitement and the brains, and stuff doesn't work.
Some of it's luck. So I don't have so much hubris that I don't. I mean, it was the welfare to work moment. President Clinton was in office, and that was his big issue. He cared about the poor.
You were able to capitalize on
and
all of
it. I did, and the working poor. And so every day in the New York Times, there was a different article on the poor and working poor. I can't remember the last time there was an article in the New York Times on the working poor now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, we talk about education, other kinds of things, but it's not the working poor. So I was riding a wave of welfare to work organizations. Now also there are so many entrepreneurs. And when I did this in, you know, 95, no one could spell entrepreneur. Right. I still have trouble spelling it.
Right.
But in 95, like, this was a new, weird, quirky thing. And I was a new, weird, quirky kid.
Who then just said, I'm not graduating from law school.
I dropped out. Much the
smartest move you ever made, you
well,
think?
Yeah. My Jewish grandparents were really sad because at the time I was both not married and not going to be a lawyer.
And had no intention to go to med school either.
Right, exactly. They were pretty disappointed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I had a lot of disappointed family members. But, I was learning too much and it was growing too fast. And law school just sucked. Have I said that enough times?
So what did you take as a salary? Because at some point, the volunteerism.
I was not on the board. The board voted a salary.
Wait,
for me.
So did you form the board?
No, I helped create the board, but I didn't believe that if I was going to be the executive director, that I should be on the board. That's a philosophical thing in the not-for-profit sector that people are very split on.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in the camp that the executive director or CEO should not be on the board, that they should be separate positions.
How many people are on a board? 13 people? Five people?
This is what's crazy. We had a board when we started of seven. The average not-for-profit board size in America, 21, which is large.
Mm-hmm.
It's very large.
And unwieldy.
Yeah, unwieldy. Especially because there's a Bain study that says the optimum number for decision-making is 7.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone you add after that decreases decision-making capability by 10%. So you do the math when you have 21 people on a board. So,
and everybody's got an opinion.
Yeah, or doesn't show up, and you have dead weight and all
right.
kinds of things. So anyway, so I was not on the board, and the board voted me a salary of $30,000.
That was fairly respectable
in
95.
That was fine. As a not-for-profit 23-year-old,
sure.
That was fine. I had no complaints. I was so excited to have my first kind of grown-up paycheck other than, like, you know, the jobs I had had.
For
summer type things. And so there you go. That was my first job, executive director of Dress for Success New York.
Now, I also read that at some point $30,000 was not so impressive. And I think the line was, especially for somebody who liked shoes. And so that in order to supplement your income, you played poker.
Ah, you did your homework. Yes.
Yes, I did. That's very – well, I also have a husband who's very into poker, but that's fairly impressive. Although I was trying to remember, because I was certainly in the city then and doing news of these – underground poker clubs.
Yeah.
Where'd you go? Like 42nd Street?
No, actually, you want to know the funny thing? So, do you remember Tabla? It's now a different restaurant.
Danny Myers.
Danny Myers restaurant on Madison Square Park.
Yep.
And you know how across the street there's a courthouse? In the basement of the courthouse was a very famous poker club.
Get out. So you were doing some underground stuff.
It was called
the
Mayfair. It was quite a scene, and that's where I spent my Friday nights for a few years.
Why'd they let you in?
Cash plays. Doesn't matter.
Didn't matter your gender. Well, I don't know. I think
there were two other women in the club. This was before poker was really big online. And look, I did this to make like petty cash.
Got it.
To shoe money, I used to call it, so that I could buy shoes that I liked.
Mm-hmm.
But really, also, the dress for success thing, everybody kind of assumed that I was sweet and that I was some like really nice girl.
That you might have been a nun?
Maybe. Yeah, like a Jewish nun. Right. A social worker.
There's an oxymoron.
A social worker. It's the same
thing. Right.
And I'm not. Like, I don't think anybody who knows me would actually describe me as sweet or, let's just go with sweet. I'm not that I'm not a nice person.
Would they call you ambitious and aggressive? And those tend to be negative terms for women
They
really are positive terms.
Yeah, but I think there are lots of other words I'd use to describe me, like savvy or street smart, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the fun thing about playing poker with big fat guys from Staten Island is they really didn't care who I was or what I did. They didn't really even learn my name as long as I had cash.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really fun to push them around.
So then Giuliani came in and said,
"We're at it."
And
then Giuliani shut them down. And so then—
You had a commute.
Then I went to Atlantic City for 2 years by myself. That was just dirty.
You said you learned a lot from playing poker in terms of—
So much.
What did it teach you?
So the interesting thing about poker, I'm not particularly good at math. I should suck at poker. You really should be sitting there and calculating odds and things like that. And I couldn't. I'm not that great at calculating those things in my head. So I did things like, it's called play position. So like where you sit around a table really matters. And that's a good thing to learn. Sort of like where you are in a room, where you fit on a pecking order of people, when you speak and when you don't, who you look at and who you don't look at, the kinds of things you say and don't say. That's a whole set of learnings just from playing position. Then there's all about valuing a hand and whether or not something is valuable. And it's valuable in the context of other people. And so the assets that Dress for Success has, or now that Do Something has, are valuable only in the context of whoever I'm sitting across from at a table. So if I'm talking to Coca-Cola, having 2.2 active members is not that interesting because Coca-Cola is massive. But if I'm sitting across from, someone else.
You mean 2.2 million?
Yeah, 2.2 million
right.
is not an exciting number to Coca-Cola, but it's a very exciting number to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
So like what you talk about and what you don't talk about in a pitch meeting, for example, that's a great thing to have learned from poker.
So these are life lessons as opposed to things that you would learn in a classroom.
So all of these women should just go out and play poker with big men from Staten Island. That's the takeaway. I don't get scared. I don't get intimidated. Because for the first few times that I went into these clubs, I mean, the first time I went in, a friend took me the first time. And I literally, after 15 minutes, had to go out onto the street and I threw up on the street because I was so nervous because he said to me, you know, don't look at anybody. That one was a gun runner. That one really was in the KGB. This one nobody knows but nobody talks to. Like those kinds of things. And I just thought, I'm a nice girl from West Hartford, Connecticut. What has happened here?
Why didn't you try to just get another job? You know, work a second job.
That's so boring.
You're right.
Yeah.
You're right. So... you're playing poker. You're running Dress for Success.
Right.
Did, by the way, at some point before you moved on to do something, did you do something in your personal life?
I did. So I turned 30.
Mm-hmm.
I had my first.
Was that traumatic?
Very traumatic. I turned 30. I had my first straight flush. And, no, this is all part of the same. This is within like a 6-week period.
Okay.
Which is a big deal. My first straight flush. And also like these two big Greek guys stayed in with me to the river. It was pretty exciting. So
what does that
mean? That means they were too dumb to realize that I had the nuts. Like you should read when somebody else has a straight flush, you should either be reading that they have a flush or a straight at the very least. And they read me for nothing. They just were ignoring me at the table.
So
they lost so much. It was a great big pot. It was really nice. So I turned 30. I had my first straight flush. And 9/11 happened. And then a couple weeks later, I met my husband. And he moved in 6 weeks after that. And then I gave notice.
I've done what I've done.
The chapter's done. And by the way, I haven't really touched a deck of cards since.
Oh, yeah?
That's done.
You don't even play for just, like, on Thursday nights the way my husband does with a group of guys?
I don't think I could. I don't think I could. I mean, I that's not how I played. It was not a social game.
This was business.
Yeah. This was shoe money. It was more serious than business.
So did you buy a lot of shoes?
Absolutely.
Okay, excellent. So you said, it's time for me to go. I've been here. I've done that. Whatever it is that I can do.
Yeah, nobody believed me.
They just thought that you would be there forever?
Right. Totally. I mean, because
because this was your baby.
Well, social entrepreneurs don't leave. They leave in a pine box or on a stretcher.
Oh, I didn't realize
that. Name
a
not-for-profit founder who's left.
I guess I can't do that.
Nobody does.
Because why? They're so branded
by it? It's a really good deal.
It's a great gig, huh?
You're in charge. Everybody tells you you're awesome. Oh, my gosh, you're so wonderful. I love this organization. You just go around collecting all kinds of awards. And you're an entrepreneur, but you're a social entrepreneur. Like, you're going to heaven. Yeah,
right.
It's pretty good. It's not about the money. It's totally about the ego.
But what about also, you must be invited places.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Pointed, oh, there's, you know, Nancy Lublin.
Well,
you know.
I don't know about that, but
oh, come
you
on.
Do get,
I mean,
you
don't
get
be disingenuous. Don't you think that, you know,
no, you, get
you
to,
were so famous. You were famous.
No.
You weren't famous?
No, I was like not-for-profit famous. It's like.
But everybody, I'm not deifying you, and I'm really not, and I'm not sitting here in awe of you, but the fact of the matter is you started an organization that has tremendous staying power. Everybody knows Dress for Success, except maybe my 4.5-month-old granddaughter.
But why would you leave that? Right? So people don't leave. People really
but
they don't
leave. But you left.
I left. I got bored because I didn't set up to start a cult like that. And I don't care to be deified. I started something that would have impact on the world. And it was. And it had grown to the point where anybody could run it.
Got it.
And so I was bored.
Did you pick your predecessor?
I did. I did. She was
no,
a woman,
not predecessor.
No, successor.
Successor.
I picked. She was running our New York office, and she was and still is enormously capable, and she is still running it today. She's been there a long time.
When you left, were there branches all over the place?
Yeah, we were in 76 cities, four countries.
Share one great success story about a woman who came and got. Can you do that?
Yeah, I think my favorite story.
Oh, that's better. Your favorite.
Yeah, no,
story.
This is my favorite. This is my favorite story. I haven't told it in a long time. This was a long time ago. My favorite story was we were in the shop one day, and all of a sudden it got very busy. There were, like, lots of clients in there at the same time. And one client just started helping the other clients. And I was like, you're fantastic. I want to get to know you. You know, tell me your story. And it turns out she had worked for New York Telephone for years, back when it was New York Telephone. And then she gave birth to a child who was born mostly deaf and mostly blind. And childcare for a special needs child is very difficult to get and very expensive. So she stayed home as long as she could. Then she had to go back to work. Then her mother took care of her son. Then her mother got sick.
Was she a single parent?
She was a single parent. So then she was a caregiver to both her mother and her son.
Wow.
And eventually the benefits just run out. New York Telephone had to let her go. And they were homeless.
Wow.
For years. And I said, you know, so what's different now? And she said, well, he's 13 now. And he just got himself a scholarship to the Jewish Guild for the Blind. I love the way she said that also. He got himself a scholarship.
Uh-huh.
And I said, that's amazing. And she said, yeah, so now I can go back to work and be a role model for him.
Wow.
She was really terrific. And she had a job interview somewhere. And I had word. Gloria Steinem was on our advisory board.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that she was looking for a receptionist. And I called Gloria's office and said, I need you to meet somebody. And I just have a feeling about this one.
And you wanted to make a match.
Yeah, and I did. And she worked for her for years as a receptionist in Gloria's office.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Now move forward to dosomething.org. I'm embarrassed to say that I did not know of this organization.
You're not really our target market, so that's okay.
That is a good point.
That's okay, yeah.
But that doesn't mean that I don't know the NHL, you know, even though I don't play hockey. How was this? I know you didn't give birth to this
right.
organization, but how was this born and why?
So this was started, this is like the original celebrity started not-for-profit. So when Andrew Hsu was on Melrose Place, the first time Melrose Place was out in the, I guess, early 90s, he could have used his celebrity to start a cologne line or a line of sneakers. And instead, he founded Do Something in 93. And the whole idea was to make community service as cool and fun as sports
mm-hmm.
in school. He was a soccer player. And when he was super famous and on the cover of magazines and on Jay Leno six times a year, Do Something was high flying. And when I got there in 2003, well, they called me in 2003 and said, hey, can you come run it? Because Melrose had been off the air for years. And the organization had really fallen on hard times. Times had changed.
It was, did he run it while he was acting?
There were other people who were running it.
Because you can't really do both.
It was a vibrant organization for years. I mean, it was really great. And then the climate changed. It was kind of part of that. In 93, it was part of like Clinton and young people making the world a better place. It was really caught up, swept up in all of that. And when 2003 rolled around, again, it was post 9/11 and priorities in the country had changed. Bush brought in his own priorities, which were more things like education and AIDS. And so people weren't really talking about young people and social change that much. And the organization was really a mess.
And
I thought that was awesome.
They contacted you?
They contacted me. Actually, they needed someone to run it. They had just laid off 21 out of 22 people.
Yeah.
And they needed someone to run it. And they called Wendy Kopp, who founded Teach for America, and said, Wendy, who do you know who can run this? And Wendy said, you know, Nancy just left Dress for Success, and I think she's trying to figure out what's next. Why don't you call her? And so so I met with them and sat across the table from Andrew Hsu and found myself giggling the entire time because he's,
oh my gosh,
he's right. Super handsome. Mm-hmm. I mean, even today, he is super handsome. And yeah, that was mortifying. And I thought, well, you know, there is a need for a fun, edgy youth organization that's not 100 years old. You know, something like an alternative to the Girl Scouts that doesn't require a uniform.
That's a lot sexier.
And it's a lot,
I mean.
Yeah, thank you. Sexier. That's a good word for it. And I thought, like, this would be really interesting. And at the time, I was being headhunted for big jobs, but really just to make the headhunter look good. Like, oh, look, we're bringing you a 30-year-old candidate. Look how outside the box we can think. But no one was really taking me seriously. Again, they kind of thought that I was sweet and I had gotten lucky. And I took the Do Something job in part because I wanted to prove that I've got the nuts.
Yeah.
And that I could make stuff happen. I never thought I would stay this long.
What kind of matches do you make?
So Do Something is the largest organization for young people and social change.
Meaning what?
So we have 2.2 million kids already this year who have done something because of us. We run campaigns. We'll do about 24 cause campaigns this year alone.
And so they join a campaign.
They join these campaigns, and we have them largely through technology. So we text with them. Mm-hmm. We email with them. We're on Facebook with them. We run these cause campaigns. Can you guess what the top two causes are that young people care about? If you were a 13-year-old girl, a 15-year-old boy, what do you think the top two causes are? If you look at the analytics there, like what the top five causes are at any point in time, there are two that are evergreen, always in the top five causes. That if there's any parent who wants to get a kid excited about social change, you pick one of these two and start with them.
Is one of them have to do with the environment?
Nope.
Well, I don't want to embarrass myself.
Okay, so it's animals and homelessness.
Well, I never would
so
have
those
picked either
are
one of them.
The two top causes for young people. And if you think about it, it makes sense. There are things worse off than them that they can understand.
Okay.
So so we knew we had to do something big around homelessness. And we called all the youth shelters and said, what do you need? You know, what do kids when they're homeless ask for?
You called all the youth shelters around the country?
500 of them.
Wow.
We took 3 weeks, put someone on it full time, and we called all the youth shelters because there was no list. And we made a list of all the shelters that accept young people and said, what do you need? So, again, if you were homeless and a young person, you showed up at a shelter, what do you think you would ask for? What would you want?
I'd want clothing.
You're the only one who's ever guessed it. People usually say, I'd want a shower, a bowl of cereal, or a phone. It's blue jeans. They want to feel like every other kid. They want jeans. So we created a campaign called Teens for Jeans, where kids collect their gently used jeans. I mean, going back on my roots to Dress for Success, right? So gently used jeans, and we collect them, and you bring them to an Aeropostale store.
Right.
And we do this in the end of January, early February, when Aeropostale really needs the foot traffic because no one's shopping that season. And in about 3.5 weeks each year, we collect about 1 million pairs of jeans. And distribute them to 500 shelters around the country. Aeropostale estimates that between 300 and 350,000 kids come into their stores as part of this campaign.
So
this is big scale stuff. When I say we run a couple dozen campaigns a year, we have about 100,000 kids per campaign. It's big scale stuff.
So I can just be one individual and just go to my local Aeropostale
and drop off your jeans
in the mall.
Or you can organize it with your friends and, like, at the basketball game at school, say, in order to get into the basketball game, you've got to bring a pair of jeans.
Great.
Yeah. And so we do it like that. We run these campaigns that you decide how you want to make them come to life. So you make them your own. You lead them.
So what do you do there exactly?
Well, less than I did at Dress for Success in the old days, where I did everything. I think the role of CEO, I've got 47 full-time staff. 8 of them are over the age of 30.
So there is somebody for you to talk to.
Only eight people. Only seven people. No. I love the young people on my team. They're very young.
Mm-hmm. What's the age limit to be part of that campaign? 13 to what?
Oh, on my campaigns?
Well, no, to be
or
part of
my
the...
staff.
No, not
There's
your
no
staff.
There's no age limit on the staff. That would be illegal. Okay.
No. I mean, to participate in one of the campaigns.
Oh, we're 25 and under. So it's really kind of 13 to 25. Okay. We have some very precocious 9, 10, 11, 12-year-olds. Yeah, it's teens. We shoot for a 17-year-old male, which pretty much means we get a 15-year-old female. Because as you and I know, the girls mature more quickly.
Oh, and are far more together than the boys.
Exactly.
Are. Anyway. Okay, so where was
So what do I do? I really see my job since So my team is so young. I see my job as like helping them. I kind of put out fires and I have a lot of teaching moments all day long. I explain a lot of things. It takes far more patience than I ever knew I had.
Well, you're described as the CEO and resident old person, which of course
is. Chief old person.
I mean, obviously next to a 13-year-old,
right?
You're old.
Well, no, my
team
is all in their 20s. Yeah, they're all in their 20s.
I mean, you're just in your early 40s, right?
Yes. But my title is CEO and Chief Old Person. That's legit. That's really on my business card. And so I spend a lot of my time. I do strategy and vision and a lot of talking to and teaching people on my team and helping them refine and follow their own instincts. They're really smart. And I spend a lot of time learning every day.
You're happy there, meaning that you're accomplishing what you want to accomplish through this organization?
I am. You know, every day.
Do you also do political stuff? I mean, you can rally those troops in terms of.
We don't do politics.
Okay. All right.
You know why? Kids don't care. Young people are not interested in politics. They don't see Washington or Albany as a solution. They do believe that they are solutions. Young people do believe that they can change things and that they have the power to create companies that will have impact or raise their voice, but they don't believe much in politics, so we don't do much in politics.
Well, that's the next generation coming up, though.
That's right. It actually gives me great hope. I mean, it does. Mm-hmm. It makes me – they have a great sense of ownership. They understand that they're inheriting the earth, and so they want to take care of it. They don't want to vote for somebody else to do it for them.
Got it. And this organization is worldwide?
It's all over the United States, and we now have do some things in the UK, five countries in Africa, Indonesia. So we're starting to spread internationally.
Were you involved, for example, in post-earthquake Haiti?
We sent jeans. We actually sent 100,000 pairs of jeans down to Haiti.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So what's in your future?
You know, I'm having a good time right now. It's just been my 10-year anniversary at Do Something, and I'm kind of surprised that I'm still there, but it keeps changing. So a third of my team writes code. We're a technology not for profit. We do a lot of work in mobile, and so that's
so
been a whole
hip.
New thing.
Very okay.
No, it's more than I've really had to learn, and it keeps changing.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be hard to get bored. And the issues that they care about, with the exception of animals and homeless, also keep changing. So I'm not bored yet. I also am very lucky in that my board of directors allows me creative freedom and space to kind of spin out other things. So this year alone, in 2013, we have spun out two other companies. So one of them, our COO, is running and is president. So she's COO of Do Something and president of TMI. TMI is too much information.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we do. We have too much information at our fingertips and too many companies wanting us to sort of teach them how to work with young people. And so we created an agency called TMI Agency that already has 3 Fortune 100 clients. So she's running that. That's one company. And then the other thing is something called Crisis Text Line. We text now about 1.3, 1.4 million kids a week. And so we might text them about Teens for Jeans.
Mm-hmm.
And we will get back a couple dozen text messages that are what I call out of flow, having nothing to do with homelessness or jeans, but things like help, I'm being bullied, I don't want to go to school.
Right.
Or I'm cutting, or about an eating disorder. And the worst one we ever got, and this is word for word what it said, he won't stop raping me. It's my dad.
Oy.
He told me not to tell anyone. Are you there?
Wow.
And it was the are you there that really kind of grabbed us by the heart. And so we built a crisis text line.
Wow.
There is no 911 by text. You can't text the number 911. It's a 3-digit code, and short codes in the U.S. are not 3 digits. So we built a crisis text line. It just launched recently. The number is 741-741. You text anything to it, and it's free 24/7 counseling by text.
That's fabulous.
It's really pretty awesome. That's maybe the thing of everything that I've done that I'm most excited about, actually.
Must be so great to go to bed at night and just feel
tired.
No, I was gonna praise you in terms of how fabulous you might feel.
No, thank you, but
It's all in a day's work.
I just think people assume, people are like, oh, yeah, doing the social change stuff, you must feel so fulfilled. But like anybody else, I go to bed at the end of the night with like a, oh, shit, I forgot to make my kids lunch for tomorrow morning. Or, I forgot to respond that email.
Pants on one leg at
a time. I'm just like, I'm normal. Yeah. And I have like hangups like everybody.
Well, I think more than normal, you're really refreshing. And I had the best time meeting you.
Thanks.
I don't know what else to say, but except continued success.
Thanks.
You're hoot and a half, and keep us posted as to what you're doing.
Well, thanks. This has been fun.
Thanks a lot. Join us for another edition of The 51% Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.
Thanks for listening to The 51% Conversations with Creative Women. For show comments and suggestions, please follow us on Twitter at Sandy Klein Show. You can also find us on Facebook at The 51%. The show is produced and recorded by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studios in New York City. Sandy Klein is our executive producer.